As David, Mary, and Lisa Blackwoods have a problem that they cannot solve on their own. They've been the targets of a campaign of vicious personal attacks in the form of statements posted on the Internet. These personal attacks are not a mere one-time angry Internet post. This has been a campaign put in place by defendants J. David Williams and his cohort, Michelle Ramey, to post a variety of vicious statements on a variety of websites to maximize the impact of these defamatory per se statements.
But, of course, the Blackwoodses did not name Eccentric Ventures as defendants in this case.
They did not, and at the time of the complaint was filed, I don't believe they could have.
Well, but you see, you're trying to enforce the injunction against Eccentric, and I'd like you to discuss why you think the Williamses, in a constitutional sense, I'm thinking of cases like Hansberry against Lee, were adequate representatives of Eccentric's interests.
Obviously, the Williamses didn't appear at all, and so to suggest that they are adequate representatives of Williams' interest, I don't think I would agree with that. I believe Eccentric has been an adequate representative of its interests in the proceedings so far.
Well, but you're trying to go under Rule 65D, and so putting to one side the fact that the Williamses didn't appear, let's dig down one level lower and ask the question whether there is a harmony of interest between the position that the Williamses occupied and that of Eccentric.
I don't think they are in the same position. The Williamses' interest is in the defamatory statements that they made, to the extent you can have an interest in a statement like that.
So the Williamses actually couldn't care less whether, I mean, they almost would prefer to see Eccentric not take the statements off, assuming, you know, I'm aware of all the contractual issues out there, but they really have a quite a different package of legal interests than that of Eccentric.
They do. We're not suggesting that they have the same interests. I think the Williams are sitting there on the sidelines cheerleading this case and cheerleading Eccentric's efforts.
So why is it, in your view, that Eccentric, never having been served with process, never having been brought into this case properly at all, never having had an opportunity to present whatever defenses it might have, can just be swept in under Rule 65D to this case?
Well, I don't think it's fair to characterize Eccentric as being swept in as a defendant. They're being brought in as a third party who essentially has possession of the property that's at issue, which is the defamatory statements.
Aren't you quibbling here? Because they are being asked to change something in their business model, if you will. They're being asked to effect under legal compulsion a change of position.
Sure they are. In the same way we would ask a bank to make a change in their standard business practices to freeze a bank account when someone has been assets frozen.
I know that's the analogy that you're trying to use, but it seems to me, particularly because of the Communications Decency Act, but also in general, somebody in the position of Eccentric is not like a bank that knows it has a client and gets personal service of notice that there's going to be a freeze order delivered in a formal way to the bank. There are a lot of differences in that situation.
Well, on that point, Your Honor, I disagree. They have had personal service of the notice. They've had an opportunity to raise all the arguments, which they have raised at the district court and are raising here today. I think under Rule 65D.
But you didn't sue them. I mean, they're, of course, raising, among other things, a personal jurisdiction defense. What have they done in Illinois, particularly in light of the recent Eighth Circuit decision?
I think this court's and this circuit's precedent on personal jurisdiction in a Rule 65D situation has made it clear that a party that is aware of an order and aids and abets a defendant is going to be subject to the court's jurisdiction regardless of where they may physically stand.
Right, but you're assuming aiding and abetting, which is an active action, if you will, taken by somebody, and I'm not sure that you have surmounted that barrier.
Well, and I think that's the central issue here, is what constitutes aiding and abetting. Your Honor, this is a situation where Eccentric has argued that they are acting passively. But passively is not a defense here, because an omission to act can just as easily give rise to liability and contempt under Rule 65D as an action.
So in your view, any Internet Any entity that maintains a web page on which comments can be posted is liable to anybody or must comply with court orders issued by any court anywhere in the United States simply when somebody mails a letter to them telling them that this court order is in place.
Well, I'm not asking the court to issue anything quite that broad. We're asking the court under these
facts.
But how
is your case narrower than that?
Well, for a couple reasons. First of all, we're not asking the courts, we're not suggesting that in any situation this is going to be the outcome.
But
I think
it will
in this
be a
case,
situation anytime. Are you familiar with this recent case, Johnson against Arden from the Eighth Circuit? It was similar. There's an Internet gripe site. Somebody complains about a Missouri cat breeding service and says all sorts of really horrible things about them, just as your clients had suffered. I mean, nobody doubts that the Williamses said very bad things. I mean, but the Eighth Circuit finds there's not enough of a link to the jurisdiction.
I'm not familiar with the case, Your Honor. And under the case law that we reviewed and prepared for, under this circuit's law, I think there is sufficient jurisdiction for the action that we're asking, which is simply the removal of a post.
But what should they do? And they really haven't done anything in Illinois, right? They just are out there, and there's probably a lot of stuff on this site.
They're not physically present in Illinois. They haven't done, you know, anything in Illinois, though I think arguably, which may not be the issue here, that their continued action once they had notice of the order may ultimately give rise to liability as directing a tort at Illinois, but that matter is not before this court.
But you could, if you had registered this judgment in South Dakota, you'd be making the same argument in South Dakota. If you'd registered the judgment in Hawaii, you'd be making the same argument in Hawaii, because the Internet's everywhere.
Yeah, but we wouldn't have a venue there, but yes.
Why not?
Because our clients
Under your view, they've aided and abetted there.
They've aided and abetted there, but our clients reside here, and this is where first of all, the defendant's tort is directed to Illinois. Now, arguably, not the issue here today, but arguably, once they have notice, Eccentric is committing that tort and directing at our clients here in Illinois.
Well,
of course, I think Illinois
the CDA is a problem with that. But
it may be, but
You should have sued them and seen whether the defense worked or not.
Well, Your Honor, at the outset of this case, to be perfectly honest, when we sat down and decided the strategy of this case, did not occur to us that for a minute, if we obtained a judgment against the Williams, that anyone would not take these posts, these horrible statements, off the Internet. Not even ripoff reports that we've interacted with in the past. Didn't occur to us for a minute that they would resist taking down three simple posts that they can't possibly have any interest in off the Internet.
They say they never take anything down. Have you experienced to the contrary?
They also say in their briefs they will take things down if they deem it's appropriate. Do I have specific instances where I know of them removing a post? I don't. There's been a lot of other allegations in other courts that they do in some of those cases, and I have not reached judgment. So I'm not going to speak to those. I don't have any personal knowledge of it. They say in their own brief that they do, when they think it's appropriate, take posts down, and they retain the discretion to do that. Your Honor, saying that you don't ever take posts down and claiming that is passive behavior would be no more different than a bank saying, well, we don't freeze assets, and simply ignoring a court asset freeze when they receive it. That's our policy. We don't freeze it. You cannot, by policy, avoid an action if you have a duty to act. And that's really the question here.
Well, the problem, again, the freeze order is directed to the bank. It is a court order directed to a bank. You don't have a court order directed to Eccentric because you never named them.
Well, you don't name banks, and you get court order directed to banks either. The court order here is directed to Internet website providers to provide reasonable assistance here. As far as we're concerned for Eccentric's rights to be represented here, this case is not going to be like other cases, because I think in any case like this, the website provider is going to have an opportunity to make any kind of due process argument that it feels is necessary. Someday there will be a case where removing posts will be too burdensome, and they have a right to be heard on that. It's just not the case here where they can claim it's burdensome. There's no question that under these circumstances where a court issues an injunction to a third party like this, the third party should have a right and opportunity to come in and raise any due process concerns it has. And that is, in fact, why we didn't come into the court and say, hold them in contempt. We simply came in the court and said, let's work this out. Let's clarify whether the injunction applies to them. They've raised
Why isn't this just an end run, though, around the CDA?
Because the CDA deals with, well, first of all, I disagree with the position that the CDA provides absolute liability here. It is called the Communications Decency
Act. Well, they're not, but under the CDA, you would agree that Eccentric is not the publisher of these scurrilous reports.
I would agree that at the outset of the case, that's true. I think it's an open question as to from the time they received the injunction and notice
really?
Of the defamatory statements. I think that's an open question, whether they could be sued for their actions.
Why would they?
The
why do they become a publisher just because some third party files a lawsuit?
Because I believe receiving notice of the injunction imposes a duty to remove the statements.
But the Craigslist cases suggest otherwise. I mean, there were Craigslist cases about all sorts of offensive material posted.
Those cases were directed towards very broad swaths. You're generally aware of, you know, sexual behavior on your website, not specific instances where a court has said these posts, they're defamatory per se, they're harming somebody. Eccentric is making a conscious decision to keep those up, to continue the
but
daily
where,
publication.
What language in the CDA are you referring to that distinguishes between being a publisher of broad things or being a publisher of a particular thing?
Well, actually, the CDA says speaker or publisher. And I think the best analogy to Eccentric in that situation is to be more, to, if we use a more traditional defamation context, to be the convenience store that's selling the newspaper, the bookstore that's selling the defamatory statements.
Well, those analogies have been made in Internet cases, and they've largely been rejected because Congress saw Internet vehicles as being in some kind of a different position.
Well,
I mean,
all of those cases,
I understand
all
the
of those cases I'm aware of are direct actions against the Internet service provider, and they're not the situation here where somebody went out and got the judgment against the
And I, and my only question is, I understand that difference, but why isn't your tactic simply an end run around the policy in the CDA itself, saying you shouldn't, you know, if you can't sue them directly, why can you sue them in a sense indirectly?
Because we're not seeking to impose liability. We're not suing them. We're not filing a civil lawsuit against them.
An injunction is often the result of a lawsuit.
It is often, but the remedy we're seeking.
That doesn't mean the person hasn't been sued.
The remedy we're seeking here, Your Honor, is far more limited than would be in a lawsuit. Far more limited. And we're not seeking a remedy here against Eccentric. We're seeking Eccentric's cooperation. The defendants in this case have a judgment.
Well, Eccentric has said they have a policy of not removing things because they would rather, if you will, have a rebuttal and have more speech rather than less speech and so on. Now, you may, the Blockowitzes may not find that to be very comforting, but that's at least what they say. And if they have to remove for this, then what else are they going to have to remove for?
Well, I don't think it's appropriate to punish the Blockowitzes for what might happen in the future. I think the facts of this case or what we should decide the case on, as far as, you know, removal of the posts. You know, asking a third party to assist in enforcing a defendant's compliance with the injunction is not the same thing as suing the party and seeking civil liability against that party.
Because you've defined remedy to mean only damages. We all understand that nobody's asking Eccentric to pay damages, but they are asking for an injunction to be enforced against Eccentric.
Well, that is a form of remedy, but it's not the same thing as an end run around the CDA. I think it's a bit much to say that we're...
What is the indication that the trial judge relied on the CDA here in any respect? That's just your speculation.
I don't think
it's
we've argued that
straw man. He set up the CDA and then he attacked it, right?
Your Honor, to be clear...
I don't think it has much to do with the case.
Our discussion of the CDA is to provide context for questions such as, why didn't you sue Eccentric directly? We're not here arguing that the CDA is even relevant to the case. We're arguing that Rule 65d2 is more than adequate to address the issues in this case. If I had simply argued that...
Most of your brief is about the CDA. It's not about the federal rules.
It is. And a substantial amount of the argument in the court below was about the CDA, and I don't think we can consider the whole case without considering that context of what does this context of the CDA provide to a ruling under Rule 65b2. But we're not, I don't think we're suggesting that the CDA is the proper route for considering judgment in this case.
Nelson, in looking at the baseline or threshold issue of aiding and abetting, do we have a holding by the district court that the defendants violated the injunction?
We do not.
How do we get around that? I mean, what are we reviewing here?
I think what has happened is that was certainly argued in the
question. I understand that.
The way to read the district court's opinion, I think, is that he did not find that argument persuasive, but it is not specifically addressed in his ruling.
Well, you don't believe that's central to, the fact-finding of whether there was indeed a violation?
I don't believe it's central because I believe the record clearly establishes that there's a violation. We went through and, first of all, we filed a motion for preliminary injunction that clearly established that we had the proper defendants, laid in detail how we knew that it was J. David Williams and Michelle Ramey making these posts. We also submitted a motion for special service. We laid out it again in detail how we found that the apartment address we had was a UPS store and how it turned out that the UPS store employees confirmed that Mr. Williams was, in fact, in the area. And based on those facts, we even offered to the district court that we would go in and subpoena them and find his real address, and the district court determined that was sufficient. We continued throughout the case to serve the defendants by email, and they made it clear on their Internet with some rather colorful responses that they posted on the Internet. So I don't think there is a serious question of fact. I think about that issue, and I think the court's omission of that in its opinion is not because it wasn't making a ruling, but simply because there was really no dispute that they had received the order.
It was so clear that the district judge didn't need to put that in his...
Or he may have missed it. But, yes, the issue was so clear that it didn't need to be addressed.
Well, that's
interesting
argument.
but clearly, the district court also did not find that the defendants didn't violate the order. The district court's opinion seemed to turn on whether or not there was interaction.
I agree with that, but I'm just wondering whether we need that baseline finding to go forward.
And there are sub-findings as well, because what the injunction says is, you may directly contact third-party hosts who shall make reasonable efforts to ensure, there's a lot of question in there. I mean, sometimes are efforts reasonable? Are they, is their alternative solution reasonable? There are questions.
I certainly would have liked more fact findings in the district court's
I'm
ruling.
Sure you would.
I think the facts here are sufficiently clear. I think the question really for the district court was whether he had the authority to do so under the law. I think the district court erred in finding that he didn't have the authority to grant the Blackwich family a remedy that has been available to defamation plaintiffs for a long time under the law.
Do you have any other Internet cases that are exactly like this?
No, we don't.
Yeah, you don't.
No, we don't. Your Honors, I see I am into my rebuttal time here, and I would like to save some of that. The Blackwich family is without remedy unless this court or the district court can take action, and we believe the law doesn't countenance the avoidance of injunctions simply by adopting a policy of not answering injunctions.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Ms. Speth.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, Mr. Nelson would have this court believe that the Blockowitzes are victims with no remedy. That's both factually inaccurate and legally irrelevant.
It certainly seems to be a practical way of looking at this, though. And what I would like to ask you is, frankly, why your client thinks it's not bound by a court order. This isn't the same thing as saying you have to remove content from the Internet when every random bypasser comes along and says we'd like you to take it off. The set of requests coming as the result of direct court orders has got to be a small set, and I'm looking at 65D, and it says that orders bind persons who receive actual notice. Your client received actual notice. It doesn't even have to be formal service. It says by personal service or otherwise. And it covers people who are in active concert or participation being a very broad word, with anyone described in the earlier parts of the rule. So, I just don't see why your client thinks that merely because it's put in its contract of terms of service certain limitations, why your contracts override court orders.
Your Honor, we don't believe our contracts override court orders. However, Eccentric never had its day in court. Eccentric never had the opportunity to challenge the underlying merits of this case.
It's having it now. I mean, what's wrong with right now? The effort was made before Judge Holderman to bind your client to the injunction. I don't know who prevented you from raising whatever arguments you wanted. Instead, the Williamses are using you as a tool to defame in a very unpleasant way these people.
The Williamses definitely used my client's forum as a tool, I would agree, Your Honor.
For defamation, which is civilly, it's a tort.
Yes, and then they failed to appear in court in any way to defend their actions.
Right, and why should they, given your terms of service? They're very happy if you leave these posts up forever.
And my client was never given any notice of the injunction until the injunction occurred, and once the injunction occurred, it was, again, too late to look at the underlying merits of the case. We had our day in court, and we succeeded in convincing the judge that that injunction was not applicable to us because we were not parties in the underlying case and could not have been.
But you don't have to be parties in the underlying case under 65D. Indeed, it's the subpart C is separate from A, the parties, B, the parties' officers, agents, et cetera, and C, other persons. And so your party status in the underlying case is irrelevant.
Well, unless it's irrelevant if we were aiding and abetting a party, Your Honor.
Or in active concert or participation is the actual language of the rule.
Correct, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court has said that independent conduct does not equal active concert or participation. And this is completely independent conduct on Eccentric's part. And there's been many cases that have looked at that and have said if you're not first of all, the underlying defendant was not found to be in contempt to begin with. And the Seventh Circuit has said if the underlying defendant's not in contempt, you can't aid and abet a contempt that didn't even happen.
So is the real problem what Judge Flom was mentioning, that we really just need to send this back to the district court and say there are more findings you need to make, you need to jump through a few more hoops, make it absolutely clear as if it weren't pretty clear already that the Williamses are in contempt, make the finding about violation, and then bind you?
Still have not an active concert with them or participation with them, Your Honor.
Well, we don't know what those findings would be. Maybe
well,
you are.
Actually, the judge made findings. The judge made factual findings on that point, and specifically the judge said that there was no active concert or participation, nor could there be, Your Honor. My client's never spoken with the Williamses, never had any contact with the Williamses.
That's ex ante. I think your opponents are arguing once the injunction's in place, you are notified about it, you're notified about the lawsuit, and yet you are persisting in leaving these defamatory materials on your website in the teeth of the court order that requires you to make reasonable efforts to ensure that they're removed.
Very much like the non-party in the Herline versus Kanakis case, it's the Seventh Circuit case, Your Honor, where the district court found that they were an active concert, but the Seventh Circuit said they weren't because, again, their conduct was independent. In that case, the non-party continued to sell a product that had a trade secret that was enjoined. The sale of that product was enjoined by the court, and the non-party continued to sell the product that included the trade secret, arguably in violation of the court order, and the Seventh Circuit said that they had no opportunity to be heard on the underlying merits, and they did not aid and abet or be in active concert or participation with the actual party who was enjoined. Their conduct was independent.
But using the word independent, I mean, part of a defamation claim, well, I mean, defamation is the publication of material that is defamatory. And I don't understand you to say that it's technologically impossible to remove these things from. I mean, we know that that's not true.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I don't know why, once you learn of it, nobody's saying you're liable for anything up to the moment that you hear about this injunction. But you see a court order, A versus B, and you know that this has been adjudicated to be defamatory. I don't think you're making an argument that just because it's a default judgment, it doesn't count. Courts issue default judgments sometimes. So I don't know why, under its terms, when you persist in defaming these people, you haven't had every opportunity to have your voice heard.
Your Honor, the CDA does not allow the court to treat my client as a publisher. So to say that my client published the materials would be a violation of the CDA. My client is not a publisher. My client simply provides the forum. And, Your Honor, if the Blockowitzes had chosen to sue the search engines because the search engines pick this up and display it, Your Honors would be saying that's ludicrous that we would go after
right.
Google.
And they didn't.
Right.
But the thing is, the purpose of the CDA, I think, is to make sure that Internet service providers and similar companies don't have to sit there and monitor everything. But once something has been identified and it's been adjudicated to be something that should be removed, what if you had published on your website some of the confidential information that the officer in Afghanistan had leaked to WikiLeaks that was going to endanger national security if it was given wide circulation? Would you be standing here saying, oh, well, you know, we don't ever have to take that off?
I don't know what my client's policy would be on that, Your Honor, but from
I'm suggesting that if a court had ordered somebody to remove that from the website and then similar language were in the order that the third-party hosts also had to make reasonable efforts to ensure that now these statements endangering national security were removed, you'd be in very weak position to say you didn't have to do it.
I legally would be in very strong position, as I am today, Your Honor. Whether or not policy-wise my client would do something different is a different question.
I don't know that your legal position would be so strong, because if you, after being told by a court order that information on your website was a risk to national security, you, in the face of that knowledge, continued to keep it there, you might well be under the terms of 65D2C.
Without being an active concert and participation with
the
actual poster?
Well, I'm saying that would be active concert and participation. You're defining away that possibility as being active concert.
I am, Your Honor, because my understanding of the word active is to have to actually take action, and my client's actions here were completely passive.
Why isn't sitting there thinking about it, seeing here's this post, should we take it off or not, let's leave it on? Why isn't that an active thing?
It isn't, Your Honor. It's a passive. I mean, this was a mandatory order that ordered something to actually happen. Most orders are status quo. Most injunctions say leave the matter as is. This was a mandatory injunction that ordered the defendants to do something. My client took the position and continues to take the position that legally that order could not apply to my client because my client never had its day in court, never had the opportunity to make an argument about why this should not be removed.
And why shouldn't it be removed? Now is your moment. Tell me exactly
yes,
why this scurrilous material needs to stay on your website for everybody to see. It's hurting Mr. Blockowitz's accounting business. It's distorting Google searches. Why is this something that we should applaud?
Your Honor, first of all, this is an issue of free speech. And I understand that you're saying that the court determined it to be defamatory, but only because no one appeared to even defend
it. It doesn't matter. It's still a judgment of the court.
But, Your Honor, if every plaintiff who wants something removed from my client's website, there are 600,000 postings on my client's website.
And do you think you're going to get 600,000 court orders finding? Most people who are sued for defamation defend, because actually the rate of success in defamation actions is rather low in the United States.
Actually, Your Honor, I would have to respectfully disagree. In most cases, the person who published does not defend. They either do not have the money or the interest in defending, and my client is left to either defend or not defend.
So what statistics are you – I mean, did you do a study of this?
No, Your Honor. I'm simply going by my client's experiences. My client has been
involved. And I'm going by the fact that the standards for defamation in the – we're not in the United Kingdom. You know, the standards for defamation in the United States are rigorous.
Right. But the cost of defending a defamation case is also, excessive. And my client does not want the floodgates opened of everybody who wants to go and sue either somebody who's not really an author. By the way, we have no adjudication that this was really the author. But somebody who maybe wasn't really an author, or somebody who they know will not defend so they can get their ruling and then bring it to my court and say, take this down. To my client and say, take this down. My client.
Do you have any records of how often somebody has been equipped with a court order asking you to take information down?
Your Honor, I have been representing this company for 10 years, and my experience has been about once a week we get demands to take it down, and at least two or three times a year there's a court order involved.
Okay, so
it's very common.
So out of the 600,000, if you've been representing them for 10 years, that's 30 times.
Yes, but, Your Honor, that's in a landscape, in a legal landscape, where without proving Rule 65D, aiding and abetting, you cannot hold my client liable. If this court were to make a pronouncement that all you need to do is go sue some author who is not going to defend and you can get my client to take it down, that will open the floodgates. My client will be inundated with court orders to take down content. And all they have to do is find an author that, or a pretend author who they will simply say, you know, they didn't defend, and now I've got my court order. And we do get those court orders on a regular basis now. Again, if there were a ruling from a Seventh Circuit
And you flout all of these court orders, I take it. For 30, the 30 court orders you're talking about, you have refused to comply with.
Your Honor, we have complied with court orders against our client. We have not complied with court orders in cases in which we were not a party. We're not a defendant, had no opportunity to be heard, and were not applicable to us because we were not aiding and abetting the actual author of the report. And it's, Your Honor, you know, I would respectfully say my client is not attempting in any way to flout any court's order. My client is attempting to, number one, protect free speech, and number two, protect its business.
Well, of course, the defamation laws have lived alongside the First Amendment ever since the beginning of the First Amendment in 1791, so I don't see that there's any First Amendment interest in defaming people.
I agree, Your Honor. And I understand that there is a judgment that says that this is defamation, but again, it was a default judgment. For instance,
so your argument is we should just disregard, I mean, we should maybe repeal Rule 55 altogether from federal rules.
Rule 65, Your Honor? Not at all. Oh,
55.
No,
55.
Default. Oh, no. I only point that out, Your Honor, because if my client had had an opportunity to be heard, my client may have raised some of these issues.
It wouldn't have had any more opportunity if the Williamses had appeared and defended and been found guilty of defamation than you did in this case.
If the Williamses had appeared, they perhaps would have told the district court that the posting was barred by the statute of limitations.
They might have, but I'm just hypothesizing. Your theory is so broad that if the Williamses had appeared and defended and lost, you still would say that you wouldn't have to take it off.
Legally, we would not. My client may have, policy-wise, may have done something different. However, legally, it would have been no different.
Right. So I'm just trying to establish the scope of your theory of this case.
Ms. Beth, if I could just follow up on that, on this policy question and whether that could lead to aiding and abetting. Just taking that rough number of 30 over 10 years where you received the order, is your concern not only about the floodgates that you speak of, but that if you respond to just one of those, apart from the floodgates argument, the decision to respond to that one would cause you then to be not passive in the others, but an aider and abettor to the extent that those you didn't take off. I mean, let's say 29 that you did not take off.
I don't think it would mean that we weren't passive any longer. I don't think it would change that legal landscape. However, I do think it would send a message to the public that this is one way to, you know, to get my client to do what they wanted to do. So, again, it's my client is an interesting situation because of the popularity of the website. There's, you know, clearly this landscape of people watching and saying, how do we accomplish this? And I'd like to go back to where I started, Your Honor. There is a remedy here. The Blockowitzes could have posted a rebuttal. The Blockowitzes could have posted the district court's order stating that this is defamatory. They could have asked the district court to have the author retract its statement. They did none of the above, Your Honor. Instead, they have widely disseminated this statement. Currently, it appears over and over and over again on the Internet because of this lawsuit. It's been republished and republished over and over again. So if the Blockowitzes were really concerned about their reputation as opposed to making a point, they could have posted the district court's ruling, which anyone reading the posting would have learned that the district court had determined that it was, in fact, a false posting. But they didn't do that, Your Honor.
The Internet is just loaded with very irresponsible statements, is it not? Right?
It is, Your Honor. I mean, I would have to agree with you. It clearly is loaded with very irresponsible statements. And as someone representing a forum for some of these statements, I can appreciate the situation that the Blockowitzes are in. And I think I've said this before. It's not that we don't feel for the Blockowitzes.
You're saying it's sort of a slippery slope. If they do anything for anybody, they're going to have to do something for everybody.
That's what we're very, very concerned about, Your Honor, is that slippery slope, because many, many people watch my client and say, what's the way to get to them? What's the way to get them to do what we want them to do? And in many cases, not in this case, but in many cases, those are very unscrupulous businesses who are trying to chill free speech, who are trying to silence their opposers, people who want to just...
Does that include competitors?
Competitors of?
Of your client. Is that the kind of fear you have about that it would be ginned up to impact your site?
No. We are much more concerned about unscrupulous businesses whose goal is to stop people from revealing what they're doing. That's been my client's major litigation issue that my client has dealt with. Businesses who simply do not want the public to know what they're up to. And they do many different things to try to chill that free speech. And this kind of thing is one of them. Most of those court orders are situations where it's a very unscrupulous business. They went and got an injunction without sometimes even properly notifying the other side. And then they want to use that injunction to get my client to do what they want, which is to be quiet, to stop the authors from talking. And my client's passionate about free speech. So that's what we deal with here, Your Honor. And in closing, I would say that there is simply not one case where the kind of independent, passive behavior that my client is engaging in has been determined to be aiding and abetting a contempt, Your Honor. There's no cases that the Blockowitzes can point to. And we have many, many cases where companies like the Hurling case, where they continue to sell the trade secret, or the Peterson case, where they continue to sell the wrenches. Mitsubishi continues to sell the wrenches that are the subject of injunction from a patent. Many, many cases like that where the courts say independent passive conduct is just not enough for aiding and abetting under Rule 65D. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Beck. Nelson, do you want to just take a moment and speak to Ms. Beth's point about what the Blockowitzes might have done?
I do, Your Honor. I also am not aware of any case where a court has said, despite the long-standing recognition of injunctive relief under the law in defamation actions, that the plaintiffs would have to accept a lesser form of relief just because the third party hosting the defamatory statements didn't feel like getting rid of them. And that's really all that Eccentric is saying, is that they should accept a lesser form of relief, that they should continue to have to confront these false statements, that David Blockowitz should continue to just simply live with the fact that he can't even get his own accounting firm's website at the top of the search results of Google's because Eccentric's website is there. They're just going to have to continue to live with that, and that their only solution is to post defamatory statements. So Eccentric is unilaterally deciding that despite this injunctive remedy that the courts have long established, it's not available simply because they say so. And I don't think
But the problem in some ways for Mr. Blockowitz, actually saw a recent example of this, is that in no meaningful sense is anything ever deleted from the Internet. Once it's there, it's there. And people who know what they're doing can find things that are quote-unquote deleted in caches and in other things. I saw somebody just this week who was trying to delete some ill-considered blog post, and of course people found it immediately. It's everywhere. It's gone viral. So in many ways, Eccentric may be doing you a favor just to say, look, the best response, we need a remedy, yes, but the remedy would be corrective speech, not what's actually a doomed to failure deletion.
It's not doomed to failure. We've taken down the posts that from the other websites. They're gone. It takes a while. It took a couple months to get them completely scrubbed, but they're gone. They're gone from search engines. They're gone from cache pages. They're gone. And even though when I search for Mr. Blockowitz now, I can see in a Google search engine, I see references to the case towards the bottom of the page, the top result are still these defamatory statements. And if the court grants relief requesting, that too will be gone. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honors. If you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
No. Well, thank you, Mr. Nelson. Ms. Beth, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.